Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There will eventually be economic calculations made about operations in Libya. We'll get a head start on those today. AT&T wants to get a jump on its wireless competition, and the day labor laws in the United States really started to change. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, today the 21st of March. Good to have you with us. Allied airstrikes on Libya continue today. And at a press conference from Chile, the second stop on his South American trip, President Obama said that within a matter of days, not weeks, but days, the United States is going to start letting somebody else lead the operations from the front. That prospect has Europeans questioning the likely length of the campaign against Libya and its eventual costs. From the Marketplace European Desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
Britain is taking part in the operation for political and humanitarian reasons. Prime Minister Cameron wants to avert a bloodbath on Europe's doorstep and to cut a dash on the world stage. But Dan Plesch of the School for Oriental and African Studies says the Prime Minister must have his eye on commercial opportunities too.
The financial hope is that for a few million pounds in missiles and air patrols, there will be a rapid change of regime and considerable payoff in oil and industrial contracts in the post-war regime.
But any hope of a swift and lucrative operation is likely to be dashed, says this defence analyst.
No-fly zones are costly. They have always cost a fortune, and this one, I'm afraid, is shaping up to cost a fortune as well.
Charles Heyman edits the defence website armedforces.co.uk. He says the no-fly zone will merely equalise the two sides of the conflict. A lengthy stalemate is likely to ensue at enormous cost to Britain.
If you pan this out over a year, you may actually be talking about somewhere near $1 billion.
And this when Britain is closing schools and hospitals in the steepest cuts in its public spending for a generation. Heyman supports the Allied action over Libya on moral grounds, but he warns there will be a heavy financial price to pay. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Europeans are nervous about their budgets and the Libya effect, but what about costs for the United States? From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimzel continues our coverage of events in the Middle East.
The U.S. fleet is already in the Mediterranean, and plenty of Italian, French, and British aircraft are always based nearby. So enforcing a no-fly zone in a relatively small part of northern Libya shouldn't be all that expensive.
So far, it's not going to break the bank.
Defense budget analyst Gordon Adams doesn't see it the way some European analysts do. He says once the Libyan Air Force is incapacitated, policing the skies will be relatively cheap. He figures the cost of firepower to keep Muammar Gaddafi's planes and troops from terrorizing civilians at between $1 billion to $2 billion a month.
The things that will really drive this in terms of cost are how long it lasts, how intense it is, how much geography we intend to cover, and what the strategy is.
And so far, he says, those goals and strategies are still unclear. If Libya becomes a ground war or a nation-building exercise, costs will escalate. At a press conference in Chile today, President Obama acknowledged that U.S. forces are already stretched thin, but he's expecting to hand off leadership of the coalition to allies.
That's something that we should actively seek and embrace because it relieves the burden on our military and it relieves the burden on U.S. taxpayers to fulfill what is an international mission and not simply a U.S. mission.
Even the Arab League is offering to share the financial and military burdens, just as it did when the Western Coalition patrolled a no-fly zone over Iraq after Gulf War No. 1. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Wall Street was in a pretty good mood today, Libya and Japan notwithstanding. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In Japan today, electrical power has finally been connected to all six reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. That's the promising news. More troubling are reports that radiation has been found in the ocean nearby and in the food supply. Over the weekend, milk and vegetables from northeast Japan were found to be contaminated. Restaurants and grocery stores are having a tough time getting any supplies because of a gasoline shortage, all of which are hurting Tokyo's normally vibrant food industry. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz explores the economic dimensions of this disaster.
If you want to eat dinner at Boisvert Restaurant in Tokyo's bustling Shimbashi district, you normally need to book a month in advance. But this past week was anything but normal.
On Friday night, right after the earthquake, everyone called to cancel their reservations.
At dinner time on a Saturday night, Chef Kazunori Kawaguchi sits at an empty table in his empty restaurant. In the kitchen, his sous chef is preparing a sauce nobody is likely to eat. The threat of blackouts in the city is keeping people at home. Even if Kawaguchi had customers, there's not much to serve them. His restaurant specializes in food from Tohoku, the region hardest hit by the disaster. A gas shortage and widespread damage to the region have closed off supply routes.
I'm doing what I can with the food I've got left. I've added a dish to the menu called Relief Risotto. If you order that, I'll donate half the price of the dish to a rescue fund for those who've lost their homes. But I have to be careful how I advertise this. It's now considered shameful to be chasing profits because everyone is facing a tough time.
Down the street, customers pour out of a grocery store, stocking up in case of electricity blackouts. They're limited to one pack of toilet paper and three bottles of water. These limits don't apply to fish and vegetables. That's because hardly anybody's buying them. Radiation found in spinach and milk has dominated the headlines, and many here know that much of the fish in Japan is caught off the northeastern coast near the failing Fukushima nuclear power plant. Shopper Shigeo Kimura is nervous.
I'm through with eating fish. When I shop for vegetables today, I check to see which region they came from. I'm not buying anything grown near that power plant.
This anxiety poses a threat to Japan's international brands, too. Some of the country's best beef is exported from Sendai, just north of the disabled plant. Even the perception of contamination could hurt Japan's seafood industry. A Shinto priest strikes a prayer drum at a hilltop shrine overlooking the Tokyo business district of Akasaka. The sound reverberates off skyscrapers and into the vacant pedestrian shopping district below. That's where Kota Hijiki sits outside his empty sushi restaurant. He estimates he's lost 90% of his customers in the past week. He's cut staff, business hours, and now he's wondering what to do.
We might start buying our fish from the western side of Japan, away from the reactors. We're planning to start testing all of our fish for radiation. We'll also put out ads saying, "We test our fish."
Kazunori Kawaguchi, the chef who serves food from the Tohoku region, lost $25,000 in the past week, and he's not sure when he'll get his next food shipment.
I can't imagine how long I'll be able to go on like this. If it continues, it'll be hard to stick to the cuisine of that region. I've been getting offers from other regions, from southern Japan, to serve their cuisine instead.
But Kawaguchi has politely turned down these offers. He says it's a painfully difficult decision, but for now, he'd rather lose money than turn his back on a region that's helped make him successful, especially now, when the people there need him most. In Tokyo, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
At $39 billion, AT&T's proposed purchase of T-Mobile is one of the biggest deals since the recession started. That much has been all over the news today. What hasn't gotten a lot of attention is how it could reshape one of the most innovative parts of the American economy, mobile. And not just how it affects Sprint or Verizon, either. The AT&T T-Mobile deal could change the rules for everybody from app developers to Microsoft and Google and Apple. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Back before mobile phones had apps, carriers like AT&T wanted to control what software was on your phone, what it did, and how it was sold. Then in 2008, Apple created its App Store and just forced AT&T to live with it. Apple could do that because AT&T needed the iPhone more than Apple needed AT&T. Parul Desai is at Consumers Union. She says this merger could change the equation.
As the market becomes more concentrated into just a small number of wireless providers, it becomes increasingly more difficult for innovators and entrepreneurs to disrupt the market.
Just two companies, Verizon and AT&T, will have locked up access to 4 of every 5 mobile subscribers in America. Charlie Galvin is a mobile analyst at Forrester.
Well, no question AT&T's leverage would go up.
Galvin says if the deal goes through, AT&T could demand price concessions from manufacturers of handsets, or could demand phones with specific features or software that works with other AT&T services. Desai says this could have a huge impact on mobile innovation.
And that's what's most important here is the ability to access the wireless network, whether it's offering a video service, offering a payment service, or any other service or innovation that maybe we can't even think of right now.
In a post-merger world, just two companies, Verizon and AT&T, will become gatekeepers, controlling access to more than 200 million customers. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
So what can you do with more wireless access? Well, you could trade stocks on it, of course. Charles Schwab said today it's buying Options Express for $1 billion. The deal will let regular investors trade ever more complex securities right from their Schwab online accounts. Options are a big moneymaker for Wall Street, as we learned during the financial crisis. But it does remain to be seen whether they can do the same thing for regular folk. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
After the financial crisis, we don't know if Wall Street and Main Street will ever really end up in the same neighborhood. But let's say they're building some connecting roads. One of those is for options trading, a business Charles Schwab hopes to grow. Andy Nybo, an analyst with Tab Group, says options give investors the choice to bet stocks will hit a particular price.
They allow an investor to have a view on a stock, whether they think it's going to go up or down.
You can buy options without buying the stock, which makes them more speculative. And you can also use options to bet on commodities like oil or corn. On Wall Street, options trading is one of the few booming businesses left. It's grown at least 8% a year since 2002. The New York Stock Exchange wanted a piece of it, which is why it's merging with Germany's biggest exchange. Schwab also wants customers who make those options bets, whether they're mom and pop or their financial advisors.
You're not going to see a reverse in course in terms of how much investors use options. It's going to be a permanent part of the landscape.
That's Josh Brown, a financial advisor in New York. He says options traders also have what financial firms want. Schwab says options customers tend to have 3 times more money, trade 6 times more often, and use Schwab's banking services more than regular clients.
Schwab is taking something away before one of their competitors can get it.
It also puts more power in the hands of the individual investor, says Nybo.
A retail investor today can sign in, get access to many of the same tools that the most sophisticated investors on Wall Street use.
The only question, of course, is whether regular investors will know what to do with all of that power. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
NFL owners met in New Orleans today. Item number one, and probably the only item really on their agenda, was the lockout that's been going on for more than a week now. Players and owners can't agree on how to split the $9 billion the league brings in every year. Some companies on the fringes of that lockout and on the fringes of the $9 billion are saying it's going to have a major impact on their revenue. DirecTV, for one, says it could lose up to $750 million. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins explains.
Roughly 2 million football fans subscribe to DirecTV's Sunday Ticket.
Watch your favorite team no matter where you live.
The extra service runs around $300 a year. It offers special recaps, special channels, and for the super fan,
you could go ahead and watch multiple games at once.
Rodney Paul is such a fan. He grew up in a Cowboys-loving household in enemy territory near Philadelphia. Today, he's a sports economist at St. Bonaventure University.
Particularly sports fans go ahead and associate DirecTV with the NFL Sunday Ticket because you cannot get it any other way.
Paul says DirecTV worries about losing those loyal subscribers. Macquarie analyst Amy Young says DirecTV is also locked into a contract with the NFL.
Well, regardless of whether or not there is a season, the company still has to make roughly $1 billion in payments.
The big broadcast networks like Fox and CBS also stand to lose hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. The fate of the NFL season could be decided in court next month. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up, why the Triangle Factory fire still matters.
It's all being discussed again 100 years later, the right to collective bargaining, the power of unions, how to protect working people.
But first, let's do the numbers. All mergers today. The Dow Industrials put on 178 points, 1.5%, ended at 12,036. The Nasdaq marched up 48 points, about 1.8%, closed at 2692. The S&P 500 rose 19 points, 1.5%, finished at 1298. AT&T's bid for T-Mobile USA sent AT&T stock up more than 1% today. Verizon beamed up nearly 1.75%. American Tower collapsed nearly 8%. That is, analysts speculated cell tower operators would lose business as cellular sites get streamlined. Energy companies bubbled up on rising oil prices. Drilling contractor Rowan gained 5.5% today. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 3.333333%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Labor Department reports on mass layoffs for February. That's when 50 or more workers from a single employer lose their jobs. Tomorrow is World Water Day, the United Nations theme this year, Water for Cities. And elephants are scheduled to march on Washington. Yep, the circus is in town, the actual circus. It's the Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey annual pachyderm parade. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The health care reform law turns a year old this week. The White House has a whole slate of events planned to celebrate. People for whom there is nothing in the law to celebrate have some plans of their own, like reminding voters that hundreds of companies have gotten waivers to avoid one of that law's key provisions. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
Remember last year, after the Affordable Care Act passed, and the president promised us a list of changes that would affect our insurance coverage this year, like free preventive care and coverage for adult children, and no dollar caps on how much treatment your insurance has to pay for.
There will no longer be lifetime limits or restrictive annual limits on the amount of care you receive.
So, about that last rule, this posed a problem for some small businesses.
We cannot offer this to our employees if it's not capped. My name is Luke Urban. I'm the Director of Corporate Human Resources for Philadelphia Macaroni Company.
And you also have a family connection to the company, right?
It was actually founded by my great-great-grandfather in 1914.
That little noodle shop now has four nationwide factories. Crack open a Campbell's chicken noodle soup.
That's our pasta.
Every can?
Yep.
Wow. Anyway, the company provides a few of its workers with something called a health reimbursement account. It's got an annual dollar cap.
I believe it's $1,000.
$1,000. Mm-hmm. So that's not even really health insurance.
Correct.
It's just a reimbursement program to help workers pay for medical expenses tax-free and maybe give them doctor discounts. It's similar to policies called mini-meds, where there's a very tight cap on how much treatment the policy will pay for. And those limits became illegal under the health law. So the Philadelphia Macaroni Company applied for a waiver from the government, and the government said
yes
to the Philadelphia Macaroni Company. They also said
yes
to a waiver request by Denny's and Jack in the Box, and
yes
to the city of Olathe, Kansas, and the Avon Central School District, and
yes
to the Teamsters Union and to McDonald's, which has some 30,000 workers on mini-med plans. All of these employers and unions gave the government a kind of ultimatum.
What they're saying is, look, if we have to go to this right away, we're going to have to raise premiums a lot or drop coverage.
Randy Boberg is an expert on insurance markets with the Urban Institute. He says the Obama administration granted those waivers rather than risk 2 million workers being dropped from coverage before subsidies and exchanges kicked in 2014.
That's right. And what will happen in 2012 and 2013 is still up for grabs. These are one-year waivers. In 2014, the typical thing that is said is these plans won't be necessary.
You mean these mini-med plans?
Yeah, that the exchanges will offer much better coverage at an affordable level, and people who can't afford it would get subsidies.
So these businesses aren't saying we want out forever, but rather give us more time.
Yes.
This is not how the waivers were interpreted by the gentleman on Capitol Hill.
Businesses opted out, including McDonald's.
Waivers. Regarding
the secretive details of these waiver requests.
Why is the Obama administration giving a pass?
Selective waivers for the politically connected.
How politically connected is the Philadelphia Macaroni Company?
Not very politically connected.
Not?
No. No, we make pasta.
In a way, says Randy Boberg, the administration left itself open to attack by promising to raise the standards on health insurance and let people hold on to the coverage they have.
And the waiver process tries to reconcile that. And it comes out as an uneasy compromise. You know, that's life.
And that's pasta. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
In the spring of 1911, the Triangle Waist Company was one of the biggest garment factories in New York City. Made women's shirts, shirt waists, as they were called. Young women, mostly immigrants, worked there, packed tightly together, surrounded by paper patterns and piles of cotton fabric. We've got pictures of it on our website, marketplace.org, if you want to check it out. But 100 years ago this coming Friday, those piles of cotton caught fire. It burned through three floors in 18 minutes. It left 146 people dead. And that fire became the tipping point for major labor reform in the United States. Mark Levin is the producer, and Daphne Pinkerson is the director of an HBO documentary airing this evening. It's called Triangle, Remembering the Fire. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
The Triangle Factory was a place where sisters and aunts and nieces all worked together. And one of the things you did, Daphne Pinkerson, in this film is you tracked down the descendants of some of those women, some of the survivors and some of the victims. Including this woman, whom the tape we're about to play. She had two great aunts in that factory the day it started burning.
When that fire broke out, Katie told me she was actually with Rosie and then lost her in the smoke. And I don't know whether... this is so emotional for me. It's extraordinary to me how emotional it is. I think that Rosie could have gone back to look for Katie. You know, I think there was so much of this trying to find each other because she was the older sibling. And Rosie never made it out.
She knew the surviving aunt.
Wow.
The generation of survivors and witnesses is gone. There's nobody left. But most of the people that we talked to saw the pain in their relatives. Our executive producer at HBO, Sheila Nevins, she grew up thinking that she had a relative who died in the fire, but whenever her name would come up, her grandmother's eyes would fill with tears and the conversation would end. So, you know, we had to do the research to find her death certificate to confirm that she had, in fact, died in the fire.
Mark, other than the obvious 100th anniversary of this tragedy, why tell this story now? Why go back to it?
I have to be honest, I don't think we ever planned the opportune timing. All these issues that were in the middle of the Triangle Shirtwaist tragedy and the reforms that were made, it's all being discussed again 100 years later, the right to collective bargaining, the power of unions, how to protect working people. In fact, the chant that went up after this tragedy was, who will protect the working girl? And now we hear people from all sides saying, well, who will protect working people?
Let's try to put this in some historical context, Daphne. It's, as you say right at the beginning of the film, it's when the Gilded Age of great wealth accumulation in this country by businessmen is giving way to progressive reforms in the early part of the 20th century.
You know, a lot of people think the Gilded Age was a golden age, but for most people, it was a cruel environment. There were no protections, no child labor laws, you know, none of these things that we take for granted today. And in the early 1900s, 1909 to 1910, 20,000 shirtwaist workers, most of them young women, organized at a time that they didn't even have the vote. And wealthy suffragettes, they stood on the picket lines with them. There was a broad-based movement coming together to rise up against so much wealth concentrated in the hands of so few people.
Mark, what happened right after this fire? There was a great outpouring of grief in New York City amongst the working class. But what else happened to change the politics and the labor environment of the time?
Al Smith became governor of New York and was actually the first Catholic to run for the presidency. And it's really fascinating to hear his great-grandson admit that in many ways he was just a Tammany Hall hack.
Alfred E. Smith IV, you had on, his great-grandson.
That's right. And he talks about his great-grandfather and says that this fire changed his great-grandfather. And a whole reform movement started, which really culminated in the New Deal. I think part of why we remember it, and it's so important, this 100th anniversary, is that something good came out of this.
Mark Levin and Daphne Pinkerson and their film Triangle, Remembering the Fire, about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. It airs tonight on HBO. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, one last item on Japan. The research firm IHS Automotive Insight has put a number on how big a problem the earthquake and tsunami have been for the Japanese car industry. Domestic production is off more than 65%. Overseas, it isn't quite that bad, but only because the supply chain disruptions we've been telling you about haven't really started to hit home abroad yet. Once that happens, the report says, production problems will increase exponentially. Here's one that just happened today. GM is shutting down an engine plant in Buffalo, New York. The restart date is listed as unknown. And on that note, that is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow put on 178 points, about 1.5%. The NASDAQ up 48 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 rose 19 points, 1.5%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up, back here tomorrow, a safer way for those who insist on smoking in bed.
If you leave it in the ashtray and you forget about it, it's going to basically burn itself up completely. Now, with the less fire-prone cigarette, it should self-extinguish.
A new installment of Freakonomics Radio. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.